like the others, I'm pleased to be invited to talk here today. The Centre of Hypersonics, we've been going since about... Well, hypersonics in Australia has been going strongly since 1962, when Ray Stalker came back from Canada, where he was playing around with cannons and things, and invented this thing called the free-piston driver concept for shock tubes. High-speed shock tubes have been developed sort of basically since the Second World War, and we needed them in the early days of hypersonic flight, and people argue now about whether we still need them. I strongly am of the opinion that we do still need to experimentally measure things before we fly, and that becomes harder and harder the faster you go. To go fast, you basically need big forces to push things. We get those in shock tubes by using high pressures. High pressures were available at the end of the Second World War because they had all these old gun barrels lying around, and that was a convenient way to get going. Also, to get things to go fast, you need big forces, but it helps if what you're pushing on is very light. The best gas to have, of course, would be hydrogen in that respect as a driver for shock tubes. And high-pressure hydrogen, the high pressure actually makes things get a little bit denser. So your high-pressure hydrogen is going to be even better if you actually heat it up as well as making it high pressure. You imagine high pressure hot hydrogen as a bit of a health hazard. Didn't matter too much in the sort of 50s. They were all World War II veterans. They were very brave. But eventually, they blew themselves all up. There were none of them left. So they had to go to something else. About that time, helium became sort of readily available fairly cheaply. And it turned out helium was just as good. So what you needed was hot, high-pressure helium. And they had many ingenious ways of trying to heat it up, some stupid, some clever. Anyway, Ray Stalker came up with what's really the best idea and has been the standard high-speed driver system ever since, which is what he called a free-piston compressor. It's basically the bicycle pump idea. If you compressed gas in a tube, pressure increases at the same time as the temperature. You do two things at one time. So he developed this system of having a piston in the end of a tube. You fill the tube up with cold helium. You shoot the piston down the tube, rather like a cannonball. When it gets to the other end of the tube, the gas has got very hot, pressure's risen very high. If you have a diaphragm there, that'll burst, push all your gas through. You have a very good shock tube. As I said, that turned out to be the best way to do it, and we're still doing it to this day. Our group is primarily experimentally based, and we're able to do that in a competitive world scene because of these facilities, which started with Ray Stalker, and we're continuing to development of them now. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of our group, try and explain that there's a bit of method in our madness that may or may not be successful. And then I'll talk about what we're doing now and what we hope to do in the future. The first shock tubes Ray built were in Canberra, and they're still there today, T3. There is Professor Stalker. He's got a unique combination of intelligence, common sense, so you do silly things rather than stupid things, and energy to sort of make it happen. So you can do something pretty useful with your life if you work with Ray. This is who we are in the centre, just to give you a brief introduction of my colleagues. The left-hand column is sort of academics and research staff, semi-permanent. There are about 8 or 9 of us there. The important column, of course, is the one on the right, the research students. All us academics, of course, we don't actually work ourselves. We come up with crazy ideas and give them to the students to implement. So we're driven by the research students. Also, we have a lot of help these days from undergraduate students. Two of them are here in the audience. That column would be too big to fit on the board, but just remember it's there. A lot of our work's driven from undergraduate students who then go on to be graduate students. Plus, over the 20-odd years we've been doing this, there's a whole heap more people who've contributed. Just to indicate some of the people and areas. These are some of the characters. Now, as I said, we developed these high-energy shock tubes. This is T4 over on the right here. It's our current biggest facility. It uses the Stalker free-piston combination. The early work they did in these tubes was just for hypersonic aerodynamics. Later on, Ray realised we have the potential for testing scramjets in these facilities. And I got a letter from Ray Stalker in about 1979, saying he'd got this grant to do 3 years research with scramjets, and he reckoned 3 years was just about enough to crack the problem. And so I came over for this 3-year job, which we haven't finished yet. So productivity's not very good in that regard. Ray left ANU in 1977 to come here, and he sworn to give up hypersonics and work on a topic of more local interest, which was the commercial utilisation of bagasse waste from the sugarcane industry. Anyway, he turned out to be a terrible recalcitrant, and he was soon back to his old habits. And by the early 80s, we were looking at scramjet work again. We did about 10 years preliminary work on this from about 1980, when we were looking mainly at fundamental studies, some of the important engineering things that happen inside scramjets, which you've got to understand in order to make the things work. We didn't touch on the engineering problems of making flight vehicles, just try and understand some of the basics. We looked at things like pressure scaling. A scramjet has to go for a wide range of altitudes, and the pressures will change a lot. If we test them in shock tubes, we can't always recreate exactly flight conditions. We have to do some scaling, increase the pressure, put in smaller models, that sort of thing. We had to see if that would work. There's a big demand to run scramjets with as cold an intake temperature as you possibly can in order to make the combustion processes work properly. Of course, if you get it too cold, it won't burn at all. Ignition limits were a big region of study in the first 10 years. We had to look at, we weren't flying things, but we could estimate how much thrust they could generate by putting pressure transducers all around them. So by taking point measures of thrust and integrating them in space, we could predict how much thrust we could get. We couldn't actually measure drag or thrust directly, but we could do some sort of estimates from, you know, other theory as to how it might work as a flight vehicle. We looked at different fuels. We looked at hydrogen. We looked at self-combusting mixtures such as silane, which burns spontaneously as soon as they get out of a gas bottle, which caused us a few surprises. We looked at hydrocarbons, ethane, liquid fuels, building up a fundamental knowledge of how the processes work, what's important in them. We looked at combustion chamber design, how to make injectors. And about that stage, we thought we knew enough, theoretically, to build a scramjet. You know, we could put all these bits together and we'd have something that we could test or maybe fly. Of course, that doesn't include the fact that we'd done none of this from an engineering point of view. You don't know all the problems that take all these independent bits of technology, put them together as one, and expect them to all operate as they would independently, as they do on their own. So we needed to sort of take the next step, which was to do just that, but test that concept in a shock tube rather than flight. And for that, we needed to be able to measure forces. And it's very difficult if you've got a shock tube that lasts for, say, a millisecond of time to measure any meaningful aerodynamic coefficients of it. If you look at, we had models of the orders of tens or twenties of kilograms, forces of the order of hundreds to thousands of newtons, not really big forces, and only half a millisecond to measure them in. A conventional thrust balance in, say, one of NASA's wind tunnels that runs for 8 seconds reaches a sort of structural equilibrium. You push on it, the thing moves back, it strains, and stress, you know, sensors somewhere measure the force, that's fine. But they take seconds or hundreds of milliseconds to work. We can't do that in shock tubes. But what we can do is have a different technique. If you, this is a conceptual idea of some sort of flight vehicle. You flow a rise from the left, forces build up, and they send stress waves through the model, through the support structure, which eventually, if you held it there forever, those stress waves would match what's coming in. But in the transient times, that never happens. But if you do a dynamic analysis, it turns out you can correlate stress measurements made in the support structure with the incoming force. Appropriate calibration is needed, and it's quite difficult. This is actually set up here as a calibration process. You have a mass suspended on the model, cut a wire, transiently unloading it. We can use this dynamic stress measurements here to calibrate the force it just saw. Now, it becomes counterintuitive, this sort of thing, because what you measure actually, in general, looks nothing like what's coming in. Here's an example. The black line on this curve is an input from a flight, constant drag in this case, and this line is the actual signal that comes out. They don't look anything like each other. But if you do the dynamic calibration, a process called deconvolution, you can go from this and reconstitute your input. Some of the practical problems that arise is, first of all, they're strain gauge measurements, which are typically very small signals. They're subject to noise. So the clear black line there is the theoretical input. The red is the sort of experimental noise that comes on top of it. This process exaggerates noise. It basically goes on derivatives. So these little up and down bits have horribly big spiky things. So the pure data you get out is this yellow rubbish here. But it turns out you can actually filter that out. This is the mechanical rise time of the gauge. If you filter at a time scale that's smaller than that, but big enough to cut out some of this noise, you revert to the little red signal hovering over the black signal. Well, that's typical of the sort of accuracy we can get with these things. It may not look very nice, but it's a measurement that's better than having nothing. Anyway, that enabled us to go to that step, putting all this stuff together, testing things in the tunnel that might fly. And there's Ray and Alan's scramjet on a stick being tested in T4. That was the first model we ever used to get more thrust and drag.